I met a Galilean, a most amazing man. He had that look you very rarely find, the haunting, haunted kind. I asked him to say what had happened, how it all began. I asked again, he never said a word, as if he hadn't heard. And next, the room was full of wild and angry men. They seemed to hate this man. They fell on him and then disappeared. Then I saw thousands of millions crying for this man. And then I heard them mentioning my name and leaving me the blame.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show, where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Today, we're going to talk about God, and we're going to talk about death, and we're going to talk about a subject specifically that has both current and great historical relevance. We're going to talk about the death penalty, but we're not going to have a traditional show where I bring on people who are on one side of the issue or the other. No, we may do that in the future. In fact, we almost certainly will. But in the meantime, something cropped up unexpectedly that I just felt I had to share with you. Some time ago, I interviewed Mark Osler, a professor from the University of St. Thomas School of Law, about the presidential and gubernatorial pardon powers. And that was a fascinating episode, but Mark's one of those people that does lots of interesting things. And during our discussion, he told me that his real passion, no pun intended, was for something he does called the Trial of Christ. And what a fascinating subject. He actually puts Jesus of Nazareth on trial for his life. And he does it for a very specific purpose. You see, Mark is an opponent of the death penalty. And it struck him some years ago when he was down at Baylor University in Texas that many Christians, many very, very religious Christians, are also supporters of the death penalty. Unlike Mark, who's opposed to it, and he wanted to remind all Christians that Jesus of Nazareth was in fact put to death, and he was put to death pursuant to the law of his time and place. And he simply wants to put those two ideas side by side. So he's actually constructed a penalty phase death penalty trial. That is, Jesus has already been convicted of blasphemy, and now the court is going to consider whether Jesus should be put to death or given some lesser penalty. Now, he's done this with a colleague of his called Jean Bishop. Jean is a defense attorney from Chicago, and she represents the defense in the case. She represents Jesus of Nazareth, while Mark plays the role of Caiaphas, the prosecuting attorney in Jesus' trial. And Mark and Jean have gone all over the United States presenting this primarily to church audiences, Christian audiences. And every place they go, they also need someone to sit as judge. And I had the honor recently of sitting as the judge when the Trial of Christ came to Carson Newman College in Northeast Tennessee. Now, the first person you're going to hear, or I should just say, we're going to listen to a lot of excerpts from that today, as well as some commentary from Mark and from Gene, and even from some people here locally who had reactions to this Trial of Christ. The first person you will hear is Stacy Rector from Tennesseans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
I have been the host for Mark Osler and Gene Bishop since they have been in our fair state over the last few days, and we are all excited to be here with you at Carson Newman College. You do have the bios of some of the key players in tonight's trial, but I do just want to do some brief introductions. Our judge for the evening is Stuart Harris. He is an associate professor of law at Appalachian School of Law in Virginia. He's been awarded the honor of Professor of the Year 5 times in the 10 years that he has been there. He's a graduate of Princeton and the University of Pennsylvania Law School, specializes in constitutional law, and hosts a weekly radio show called Your Weekly Constitutional on WETS in Johnson City. Our defense attorney for this evening is Gene Bishop. Gene is a public defender in Cook County, Illinois, and one of the world's most well-known advocates for victims' rights and against the death penalty. Both of these positions draw on the murder of her sister, Nancy, her brother-in-law, and their unborn child. She has lectured on these issues throughout the United States and around the world. She's the recipient of the Bridget Award from Concern International, honoring women who exemplify justice, generosity, and compassion. She graduated from Northwestern University, Northwestern Law School, and was a visiting student at Yale Law School. And last year, Jean played a key role in the abolition of the death penalty in her home state of Illinois, and in fact received the pen that the governor used to sign that legislation. Our prosecutor for the evening, Mark Osler, is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas Law School in Minnesota. He's a graduate of the College of William & Mary and Yale Law School. He is a former federal prosecutor who later changed sides and won the case of Spears v. United States in 2009 in the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court held that sentencing judges could categorically reject the 100-to-1 ratio between crack and powder cocaine in federal sentencing guidelines. His work on one case is portrayed in the Samuel Goldwyn film American Violet, and his book, Jesus on Death Row, challenges the death penalty based on the experience of Christ as a criminal defendant. He's also the executive director of the Association of Religiously Affiliated Law Schools and the holder of the Richard E. Byrd Preaching Chair at St. Martin's Episcopal Church. We also have cast members from right here at Carson Newman. The Centurion will be Jeremy Hayes, Jesus Michael Lugo, Malchus Alex Davis, the Rich Young Ruler Luke Willoughby, and Simon Peter Ryan Carter. You too will be playing a role this evening, as you will serve as the jury. So at the close of the trial, you will be invited to sort of group yourselves as near as you can into groups of about 12 people, and you will be given a form where you all will have to talk amongst yourselves. So you'll be determining the sentencing, actually, not guilt or not guilty. And with that, I will turn it over for the trial.
All right. Just a few preliminary notes. I'm Mark Osler. I'm going to be the prosecutor this evening. There's a couple things about this trial we want you to keep in mind. One is that we know that blasphemy is not a capital crime now. And that is the one central fiction that we have to make this work. And so in your deliberations later, remember that all we're doing now is considering, we're pretending that blasphemy is a capital crime. And we're then applying Tennessee law as best we can to that crime for the sentencing phase of trial, which is what happens in a real capital case here. Other thing that I want you to keep in mind is that there's a few things that are going to happen in the course of this trial that are exactly what happens in a regular trial, and that is that there's a few stipulations that the parties have. And Your Honor, I'll make you aware of these stipulations now. One is that we can use the Bible to refresh the recollection of a witness if they don't remember something. And if we can impeach them with the Gospels if they misstate something in that way. Also, there's two hostile witnesses, which means that the government is going to call a witness who is allied with the defendant, and that is going to be Simon Peter. And we have stipulated that we'll be able to treat him as a hostile witness as if on cross-examination. Similarly, Malchus is one of the witnesses who's been called by the defense. And because of that, and because he is, in fact, a servant of me, the prosecutor, he is going to be able to be treated as a hostile witness if the court agrees.
Court calls a case of one Jesus of Nazareth, the sentencing phase. Will the jury please rise and raise its right hand? You need not repeat after me, but you should know that you and each of you swear that in all causes committed to you, you will give a true verdict therein according to the law and the evidence given you. If you agree, signify by saying, "So help me God." Please be seated. Counsel ready to proceed?
Your Honor,
the government is ready to
proceed. Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Prosecutor, please call your first witness. Or you have an opening statement.
Yes,
all right, you can make your opening statement. Counsel for the defense, will you be making an opening statement after his?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Please proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the job I have tonight is not one I take on lightly. It is one of the most difficult jobs in American law, because tonight it's my task to ask you not just to find a man guilty, that's already occurred, but to hear about the danger that person presents and decide that the appropriate remedy in this case is execution of that defendant. And that is what the government is asking for tonight, relating to the defendant, Jesus Christ. Again, I don't take this on lightly. It is a remedy our society only seeks when there truly is a grave danger to the fabric of our society that's presented by that individual. My job, specifically, in the sentencing phase, is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt one of three aggravating factors, because that's the way Tennessee law works, is that once someone has been convicted of a capital crime, the next step is that the jury is asked, is there an aggravating factor that exists? And if one does, then the sentence is death. I don't have to prove all three. I only have to prove one of the three, provided that your jury is unanimous as to that one aggravating factor. The three aggravating factors that the government believes can be proven and will be proven beyond reasonable doubt in the sentencing phase of trial are, first, that the defendant, Jesus Christ, has harmed and will harm children under the age of 12. We will put before you evidence that he urges children to abandon their parents to abandon their children, in the dissolution of the families that are at the center of the lifeblood of children's lives. The threat that that presents is an aggravating factor. Second, the government will put before you evidence that he poses a danger to the great mass of people in this country by undermining the economic structure of our nation, capitalism. And third, we will put before you and prove beyond reasonable doubt the third aggravating factor, which is that he is the functional equivalent of a terrorist, as he does something that every terrorist would desire, that we disarm and not defend ourselves against aggression. These things would not matter if he was without power, but he has great power. You will hear that he is capable of assembling huge masses of people who follow him almost blindly, and that he has abilities no other person has. He can walk on water. And we will put before you the question of what prison could contain that danger. In the end, we will show it's because of that power that he is so dangerous to our families, to our prosperity, and to our safety, that the only remedy that is reasonable is, sadly, that of death.
Counsel for the defense.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my name is Jean Bishop, and I represent this man, Jesus of Nazareth. The evidence at this hearing will show that this man should not be executed because the state will not be able to show any of the three aggravating factors that you've heard from. Jesus does not represent a threat to children. Rather, he healed and blessed them, and you'll hear testimony from the state's own witness, Peter, of the healing of not only Jesus' own people, but even of a royal, this child of a royal official who came to him for help. You'll hear that children were brought by their parents to be blessed by Jesus. As to the masses, you'll hear that Jesus never told his followers, gather a whole group of people together so they can hear me and follow me. Rather, because of Jesus' acts of goodness, his teaching and healing, crowds flocked to him. You'll hear testimony, again, from the state's own witness, that Jesus cautioned his followers not to say who he was. He cleansed a leper and told him not to say anything, but to go to the priests and to do the sacrifices that Moses commanded. But word spread about that, and people flocked to him. Finally, as to the issue of terrorism, terrorism is the instillation of fear. And what you'll hear is that Jesus' constant message to his followers and to people was fear not. His message was one of a loving and providential God who cared for the sparrow and who counted the numbers on our own head and who clothed his children as the lilies of the field. So at the close of this hearing, I'll ask that you find that these aggravating factors have not been proven and that you spare the life of this man.
Prosecution, please call your first witness.
Yes, Your Honor. The government would like to call to the stand Luke Taylor.
Good evening, Mr. Taylor.
Good evening.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a ruler of a small kingdom in the Middle East.
And do you have people who work for you?
I do. I have employees, servants, I guess you could say.
And your household, is it one that you would consider large or small relative to other households?
Large, I guess, to compare to some.
Have you ever met the defendant, Jesus Christ?
I have.
And how did that come about?
I approached him, really asking him how to get to heaven.
Did he respond to that question?
He responded with, follow my commandments.
And what did you say?
He listed off these commandments, and I said, well, I got that one. And then I said, well, what else do I have to do?
And what did he tell you?
He told me to sell everything I had.
Did you do that?
No.
All right. Did he say anything else after that?
He said when it came to going to heaven, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get into heaven.
Where you live, are there camels?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever seen one pass through the eye of a needle?
Can't say that I have.
Thank you. Prof?
Sir, you came to Jesus. You sought him out.
You can say that.
And you called him good teacher.
Yes.
And he stopped you right there and he said, why do you call me good? Only God is good.
That he did.
And you asked him what you must do to inherit eternal life.
Yes.
And in response, he didn't say follow my commandments. He said follow the commandments, right?
If that's your view on how it went, yes.
Well, sir, it's not my view. It's yours. You were there. He said follow the commandments, right? And he listed them and named them for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Honor your father and mother.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
And so on. And he said, if you wish to inherit life, follow his commandments, right?
Yes.
And then you said to him, I've done all those things from my youth. What else must I do? What else do I lack? Isn't that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And the reason you said that is because you felt there still was something lacking, correct?
I don't know if I felt like something was lacking. I just wanted to know exactly if he's going to listen to the step-by-step process. What exactly do I have to do?
And you came to him trying to find an answer to that question that you got.
And wanted to know that step-by-step process, yes, ma'am.
And then he looked at you and he said, if you wish to inherit eternal life, sell what you own, give it to the poor, and follow me.
Yes, ma'am.
And he didn't say that everybody should do that, right? He said that you should do that.
I guess he was telling that to me in particular, yes.
And you never heard him say to a big crowd of people, everybody sell what you own and give it to the poor and follow me, right?
I do not recall.
Well, you never heard him say that to a crowd, right? You only heard him say that to you.
I guess that is the only person I did say that to me, yes.
Okay. And you decided not to sell what you own and give it to the poor, and you left him.
No, you see, if I sort of had, I had because of, I own this land, and it's just not me. As the prosecutor said, I have this a large family. They own part of this land, so it's been very complicated for me to sell all the land that I actually had.
So you've kept your money and your possessions, and you left him. Is that right?
I guess one could think that.
And you left him grieving, didn't you?
Yes.
You had your money, but you didn't have your answer.
That is correct.
Nothing further.
Redirect? One question, Your Honor. The statement about a camel passing through the eye of the needle, did he address that only to you, or did he address that to the others that were there?
It was all to me.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, and today we are at the trial of Christ. Mark Osler and Jean Bishop are putting Jesus of Nazareth on trial for his life on the campus of Carson Newman College in Northeast Tennessee. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back for more of the trial of Jesus.
We turn to Rome to sentence Nazareth. We have no law to put a man to death. We need him crucified. It's all you have to do. We need him crucified. It's all you have to do.
Talk to me, Jesus Christ.
It's the constitutional quiz. Woo! And Kelly is here. We're so excited. Thanks for coming, Kelly.
Thank you for having me. I've got my coffee, so I've got some energy.
You got your coffee, and we're just psyched to go. And do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do.
And who are you?
I'm Taylor. I'm from Elizabethton, Tennessee, just down the road.
Elizabethton, Tennessee. Ooh. Wow, and that is quite near Johnson City, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Just 10, 15 minutes down the road from where you're at right now.
That's exactly right. Well, tremendous. Thanks for calling, Taylor. Now, let's go to Kelly. Kelly, what question do you have for Taylor from
All
Elizabethton?
Right. Yeah, Taylor, I have a question for you regarding the First Amendment.
Oh.
Ooh.
I don't know if he likes that, but go on.
All right. I think this is going to be an easier one. I'm told that I've been too hard recently on all of our...
You are a hard
our
woman.
Our listeners. So we'll see, Taylor.
You.
We're going to see if you can get
Let's
this.
Let's hope it is easy.
The First Amendment protects what? A, the freedom of religion, speech, and the press. B, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, and petitioning of the government. C, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, and revolution, or D, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, revolution, and petitioning of government.
Oh, excellent. I think it's B.
Well, hold on just a second here. I can't even keep these darn things straight. In fact, I'm going to suggest we give these people pen and paper, or they should bring pen and paper when they do this, just to keep these things straight.
Get your paper out.
Yeah, I've got my pen now. Okay, now what are those choices again? What is the First Amendment protects what?
Freedom of religion, speech, and the press.
Okay, well, let's go through them one at a time, and then we'll ask Taylor to pick which one he likes or doesn't like as we go through them. What was A again?
The freedom of religion, speech, and the press.
How about that one, Taylor?
Well, I like that one, but I think it's lacking a couple of the other elements. I believe there might be five.
Okay, well, what is B then?
B was the freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and petitioning of government.
There's five. Is that the one you like, Taylor?
That's the one I liked originally, but I'm glad I heard it again to make sure that it did have all the elements I thought were supposed to be included.
Okay. Well, what about C?
C, here's another five rights for you. Freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, and revolution.
Ah, the right of revolution. Okay. What about that one, Taylor?
Well, I don't believe you have a right to revolution. But
that's no fun.
What's that song, yeah, the revolution song?
Yeah, yeah.
Talking about revolution? I'm not going to sing.
Sing!
No.
Okay. What about that one, Taylor?
Like I said, I don't believe there's a right to revolution. And I still like B the best.
Like B. Okay, well, what about D?
All right. Freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, revolution, and petitioning the government.
That's D.
D. Oh, I'm sorry, that was D.
Four of the five I agree with, but I still, it's got the revolution in there, and I'm going to have to stick with B.
Okay. B is your final answer? And one last time, Kelly, what was B?
Religion, speech, press, assembly, and petitioning the government.
Final answer, Taylor?
Oh, I guess. Final answer.
He doesn't sound sure of himself. Okay, that's Taylor's final answer, B. What is it, Kelly?
Well, congratulations. Hey. Ding, 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 ding. For our listeners out there, Amendment 1 actually reads and protects those exact five rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Yes, and those are extremely important. And in fact, I think I saw a recent poll where most Americans had no idea even how many freedoms were protected by the First Amendment. But those are sometimes called our first freedoms because they're in the First Amendment. And it's not just speech, which is extraordinarily important. It's not just religion, but petitioning the government, extremely important as well, and assembly.
Absolutely.
You know, getting together with other people and having meetings. And those are all very important things, and there have been some very important cases about them. So, Taylor, congratulations to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Harris.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and today we are listening to The Trial of Christ, where two lawyers, Mark Osler and Gene Bishop, are putting Jesus Christ on trial. Now, both Mark and Gene are opponents of the death penalty, and what they're hoping to do here, they say, is to make Christians think about Jesus and the death penalty at the same time. I wish we had time for the entire trial of Christ. Unfortunately, we don't, so we're going to have to skip now to the closing arguments of the prosecutor and the defense counsel.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, again I say to you that I regret that we're all here. I regret that I have the job I have before me. I regret that I had to cross-examine my own slave and bring before you the unpleasantness that I've had to do. But there's an inescapable fact about criminal law, and it's this, that it's all tragedy, every single bit of it, every case. I wish that I had the power to heal someone's ear, because then maybe, as a prosecutor, when someone is murdered, I could unmurder them. When a woman is raped, I could unrape her. But I am just a mortal. I don't have that power. And so, every case is tragedy. And the best that I can hope to do as a public servant, as someone in the horrible role of describing tragedy to you, is to urge an outcome that will prevent future tragedy. And it's in that capacity that tonight I have to urge you to end the life of the defendant to avert future tragedy, so that our society can be sustained and be whole for us and for our children. We don't deny the power of the defendant. In fact, it's because of that very power that I have to ask you for this outcome. We can't put him in a prison. He can walk on water. There is not an easy answer here. He was able to heal people just by touching them. And yet, there were the other things, and I'll talk about that in a minute. My job is fairly simple, that I have to convince you beyond a reasonable doubt that one of the three aggravating circumstances that I described exists beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, it didn't take long to put the evidence in tonight, because it's simple. And it does show those three aggravating factors. And I'll start one that I described first, and that is the harm to children under 12. Now, the defense has put before you stories, undoubtedly true, of his healing children. Healing children of an injury, of a sickness. A handful of children. But what about the society he wants to create? What is the, if you were to think to yourself, what is the greatest harm to children that a person could urge? Wouldn't it be abandonment by your mother? Wouldn't it be the wrenching apart of families? The very thing that he urged over and over and over. We heard about three instances tonight. He came to set a mother against her daughter, a father against his son. And that's exactly what he taught. That for his sake, for the defendant's sake, families should be rent apart. That he is more important than the unit of a family. And I cannot imagine anything that would be more dangerous to children under 12 that was more dangerous to young children than exactly that. And more than that, when children are there, what does he say? First he says, these are the blessed ones. And then he says, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. Who amongst us would say that to children? This is the danger that they will do it. Cut off your own hand. We tell children to do the opposite. It's kind of a joke, isn't it? Don't do that. You might put out your eye. But he says the opposite. He says, put out your eye. His blasphemy was aimed at masses of people. That's indisputable. Maybe he didn't ask for the masses of people to come, but they came. And once they came, he gave them what they came for, which was him talking to them. And beyond that, the very fact that he preached to masses of people, the harm that he poses to society is towards masses of people. Now, we heard from a young ruler, maybe he wasn't so sympathetic because he's rich. But don't we all want to be rich? What happens to our economy if everyone does what the defendant urges? We give what we have away to the poor. Now again, I wouldn't worry about this if he wasn't so powerful, but he is. And finally, it may seem like a stretch to say that what he does is the equivalent of terrorism. He didn't have an army. We don't allege that. We're not saying that he carried arms. There were a few incidents of violence, the money changers that we heard about him turning over the tables. And certainly, we heard from Peter that he said there's a time to have swords, and then when he was arrested, Peter had a sword and used it for violence. In fact, the only person we heard about getting hurt at that arrest was my slave, Malchus. But more than that, he wants us to disarm. And what happens when we disarm? When we turn the other cheek? When we don't resist that which threatens us? Isn't that what the terrorists want? You're going to have to answer a question tonight. Does the mitigation presented by the defense outweigh the aggravating factor if you find one? So there's two steps. First, you have to consider whether one of these aggravating factors exists. And if it does, you go to a second question, which is that outweighed by mitigation? And on the mitigation that we heard, where he healed people, well, two of the people he talked about healing were slaves. And in neither case did he free them. My slave is still my slave. We heard from him tonight. And tonight, if I choose to harm him, I can do so. But why would I? I mean, he is more valuable to me because he healed his ear. But I'm not sure why that is such a mitigating fact when he remains enslaved. And what about those pigs? You may be wondering why I brought that up. Well, first of all, why was he listening to what demons said? and granting them their wish, and then granting them their wish in a way that would destroy the economic lifeblood of that town. Now, on the one hand, what an act that is, what great power to cast out a demon. But at that point, why the poor people in the land of the Gadarenes are they deprived of their economic lifeblood? How much mitigation can there be when someone urges that children harm themselves, and when a daughter should leave her mother and a mother leave her daughter? Thousands of people flock to him. He can walk on water, and he will destroy us if he's taken seriously. We must do what has to be done tonight, because the threat he presents is not to any one of us, but to all of us.
Counsel for the defense.
This man, my client, Jesus of Nazareth, sits now with his fate in your hands. This living, breathing human being. Should he live or should he die? That's the question that you have to decide now. And you have to decide it based on those three factors that you heard about at the outset of this hearing. Is he such a threat to children? Did he aim his crime at the masses? Is this the equivalent of terrorism? And the answer to all three of those questions clearly is no. Look at the evidence that you heard. You heard evidence of Jesus healing small children, of bringing a girl back from death, a son who was epileptic, another who was close to death. These were acts of love and goodness to children, just like his blessing them when parents brought them to him. The masses, you heard that Jesus wasn't trying to gather them. The word spread of his goodness and his healing and his peace and mercy, and people flocked to him, even when he tried to get away. As to terrorism, you heard that Jesus' constant message to people was not to be afraid, that they were in the arms of a loving God. Even if the state had proven one of these three factors, though, there's ample mitigating evidence, in fact, overwhelming mitigating evidence of the good that this man has done. You've heard of him cleansing lepers, of healing the sick, of feeding the hungry, and that he did this not just for his own people, his Jewish people, he did it for people who could be considered his enemies. Three of the four witnesses you heard from at this hearing were people who testified that Jesus healed the servant of a centurion who worked for Rome. You heard that Jesus healed the high priest's own servant who had come to arrest him. And most importantly and significantly, you heard that Jesus did not resist his own arrest. He stepped forward and said, "I'm Jesus of Nazareth. Arrest me. Let these other people go." He submitted himself to human authority. So the powers that you heard about him using tonight were powers of goodness for other people. You never heard him do anything that would save himself. And here he sits, submitting himself to human authority, to you, to the power that you have to sentence him to death or to let him live. And I'm urging you to let him live because killing him makes no sense. If you look at the reasons for the death penalty, there are three. One is deterrence, that if we have this possibility of execution, that it'll keep people from committing the kind of crime that Jesus did. But how do you deter someone who says that he's come to preach the kingdom of God? If anything, killing him would make him a martyr. Don't do that here. The second reason is retribution, that what he's done is so heinous and so awful that we're going to take vengeance on behalf of all society. But that overlooks the good that this man has done. You've heard over and over of his acts of mercy. I'm asking you to show at least the mercy to him that he showed to others. And finally, the third reason is incapacitation, that we've got to kill him to make sure that he can never commit this crime again. But we don't need to execute him. You have the power to lock him up for life, and I believe that the evidence has shown that he would submit himself to that authority just as he submitted himself to his arrest and to this trial as he sits here now before you. If you execute this man, you're making a mockery of the words of Micah, which are so beloved,
the prophet who said that you know, O mortal, what is good, and that is to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. There's no justice and no kindness in taking the life of this caged man, this arrested, imprisoned man, and snuffing out his life. And there's no humility in playing God and taking the life that only the Creator can create and sustain. And so I'm asking that you kill not Jesus, not because what he did was all right or excusable. I'm asking you not to kill him in the name of the Creator and the Lord of all life.
Well,
yes, Your Honor. I do ask for incapacitation because of the great power of the defendant. And I want to raise something else in response to what was offered by opposing counsel, and it's this. Who is it that he calls to follow him, and what will we lose because of that? That when Peter was on the stand, I asked him, who knew how to read amongst you? None of them. And what does that mean for our culture that's embedded in words? It's lost. We're here in a hall of learning. What happens when the leaders call to them and put up above others those who do not know the history, who don't have access to it? There's nothing wrong with being a fisherman, but having that be the leaders cuts us off from our own history. I'm not talking about incapacitating the defendant through death, tragic as that is, because any one person will be hurt. Our society is woven of a fabric. And that phrase is often used, and it's true. Families are one part of that fabric. Our economy is another part of that fabric. And when he urges those who produce wealth to give away everything that they have, when he urges parents to leave their children, the fabric tears just a little bit at first, maybe 5,000 people. But it tears. And then what do we have? Maybe one person isn't hurt, but all that we have is gone. And that's what we must avoid. Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional and the trial of Jesus Christ. Now, we've just heard closing arguments from our prosecutor, Mark Osler, and our defense counsel, Gene Bishop. And now it was my turn, as the judge of the trial of Christ, to give instructions to the jury. Now, this was the penalty phase only of Jesus' trial. And so the real question before the jury, the audience that evening, was simply whether Jesus should live or die. The judgment of the jury after the break.
Behold the man! Behold your shattered king!
We have the king, the Caesar!
You hypocrites! You hate us more than him!
We have the king, the Caesar! Crucify him!
I see no reason, I find no evil. This man is harmless, so why does he upset you? He's just misguided, thinks he's important. But to keep you vultures happy, I shall flog him!
Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we've just heard closing arguments in the trial of Jesus. Now the judge, yours truly, will announce the results. Now, there were several different groups in the audience and several different jury verdicts. We'll just go with the last couple of them.
The next group, the next jury, voted again yes on question one and also failed to specify which of the three questions. Shame on them. But also for question two, voted no and said life without parole. And finally, one jury voted yes on question one, failing once again to specify which of the three factors they were voting on. Then, on question two, they voted no, and also sentenced Jesus of Nazareth to life in prison, but they did offer him the possibility of parole. The court thanks you for your service,
and hopes that you had a chance to think about some important issues this evening. Thank you again, and good night.
And so Jesus of Nazareth escaped crucifixion at the end of our trial. All of the juries gave him some penalty less than death, though some of those penalties were actually fairly severe. I think at this point it'd be a good time to talk to Mark Osler and Gene Bishop and ask them a couple of questions about the trial of Christ, why they're doing it, and what they hope to accomplish with it. How in the world did you come up with the idea of putting Jesus Christ on trial?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, as you might imagine. It came from in the year 2000, I had been a federal prosecutor in Detroit, and I moved down to Waco, Texas, to take a job at Baylor University. And when I moved to Waco, it was an election year, and I was really struck by a couple of things. Number one was that there were political ads on all the time, and in those political ads in Texas, it seemed to be required that you show yourself walking out of church, preferably with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very Christianized political culture. And at the same time, it was hard to not recognize that there was a real enthusiasm for the death penalty there. But those two things never came together, that I never heard a discussion, other than the occasional reference to eye for an eye, of Christians struggling with the idea of the death penalty. And so after thinking about that for a while, I decided that one way to do it would be to go into a church and simply do the trial of Christ under the local rules. And in the year 2001, in a Baptist church in Waco, did the trial of Christ under Texas rules for the congregation. And it was a fascinating experience. There was no express argument against the death penalty, but it did put those two things in juxtaposition. Now, the defense attorney for that first trial was Bill Underwood, who's now the president at Mercer University down in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last year, when I thought about doing this again, I thought it would be a good idea to get him a public defender, since, of course, Christ was indigent. And the best public defender I know is Jean Bishop. And, all, of course, her background, her engagement with the death penalty, and her trial skills made me think she'd be the perfect person, and that's turned out to be true.
What do you have to say about this, Gene? Why did you agree to such a strange request from Mark?
Oh, I was honored to do it, especially to be following Bill Underwood, who's now a college president. In addition to being a lawyer, I also sing in this choir in my church. It's this wonderful professional choir in Chicago. And I really find that a lot of how things are brought to life and illuminated for people in their faith is through art. It's through things like music. And this trial is a live, unscripted courtroom drama. And it really touches people.
And I also asked Mark Osler if he had ever beaten Gene, if he'd ever actually convinced a jury to execute Jesus Christ. And he laughed and he said, "No, but I think it has to do with my jury selection." He said, "You know, we always do this in front of church audiences, and it's very hard to convince followers of Jesus to crucify him." Brings up some interesting theological questions, doesn't it? At any rate, let's finish off now with a discussion of someone from the target audience. Now, I didn't actually get a chance to interview somebody from the audience at the trial of Jesus that night, but I found a fellow locally back in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. Our local prosecutor, his name is Gerald Arrington, and he fits exactly the profile that Mark and Gene are looking for, a person who is a conservative Christian, but who also believes in the death penalty.
I'm Gerald Arrington, Buchanan County Commonwealth's attorney. I'm the elected prosecutor here in Buchanan County, Virginia.
And what does the Commonwealth's attorney do? What does a prosecutor do on a day-to-day basis?
The prosecutor is charged with prosecuting all the criminal cases that pass through the local court systems, whether it be through traffic court, through felonies in the circuit court, and ultimately jury trials.
Wow. And so that's quite a wide range of possible charges. And you have to make the decision whether to charge someone in a given case?
We do. Usually the police officer in serious cases will consult with us what charges to initially bring by warrant, and then ultimately additional charges may be brought by indictment at later stages, or even sometimes through a process, direct indictments and drug cases, things like that. And so we're charged with making the decisions of what charges to bring, how many, what we think is appropriate, that kind of thing.
And one of those charges that you might choose to bring, since we have a death penalty in this state, is you could choose to seek the death penalty in appropriate cases, right?
Yes, Virginia has a death penalty statute, and it's sort of set out for particularly enumerated statute crimes by statute, of course, all being murder cases, murder of a police officer in certain enumerated circumstances, or where the murder itself is done in a particularly heinous or violent manner, and that would fall within the discretion of the prosecutor to charge the capital punishment statute.
So this is not a penalty that's for, I know every murder is a terrible tragedy, but it's not for a garden variety murder, that is.
No, by statute it wouldn't be for a garden variety murder, and you know, a decision has to be made even in the particular cases in those homicides whether it's appropriate to bring the death penalty, even if it may qualify under the statute, because with a death penalty case, there's typically additional expenses to the taxpayer in prosecuting those under the death penalty statute.
Okay, so it's a big decision then, if anyone ever actually has to do that.
Absolutely.
Okay, and of course, the ultimate decision that lies behind all of this, and I realize it's the state of Virginia and its legislature that actually creates or doesn't create a death penalty, but I'm just curious how you, as a prosecutor, as an attorney, how you personally feel about having a job where at some point you may be required to feel that you should seek the death penalty.
Yeah, it's a heavy burden to have. Without question, I find that as being the Commonwealth's attorney who's ultimately responsible for making a lot of important decisions that affect people's lives every day, you know, there's a big sense of duty that comes along with it. And a capital murder case, I can't imagine having to be the person making that, but one day I may be called upon to do that. And I think it's a decision that you have to make. You know, you can't make it lightly. You've got to put a lot of thought and deliberation. But ultimately, I do support the death penalty and wouldn't hesitate to charge it in an appropriate circumstance.
Now, I'm just curious. Now, what I'm sure as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, and you've worked as a prosecutor before you became our Commonwealth attorney, what are the most compelling reasons in your mind, either for or against the death penalty, and why do you ultimately come out where you do?
Well, and you know, I guess some of the circumstances that I see that it's particularly appropriate, where you've got a murder of a child, where you've got a murder that's been committed in a particularly heinous or brutal fashion, where you know, multiple victims are killed. Those to me are clear circumstances where I think that the death penalty probably is appropriate. Again, you've got to look at these things on a case-by-case basis, but certainly those are cases that I would look at. Once you make that decision to charge it, you know, some of the, I guess, the reasons why I feel it's appropriate. You know, number one, with Virginia, we don't have parole. Parole was abolished, I guess it was back probably in the 1990s with the Truth in Sentencing Act. And so, while we don't have parole at this juncture, that can always be changed by the legislature should later on they decide to allow parole. And when someone's committing a crime in such a brutal or heinous fashion, you know, I think you, number one, have a justification to protect the public from allowing someone like this the possibility of coming back out on parole later. Mm-hmm. Even if, you know, parole wasn't to be, I guess, reinstated, or if you didn't even have to worry about parole, you still have to be concerned about the public safety, because where you've got a murderer in prison, you've got safety of other inmates, you've got safety of guards, you've got safety of visitors that you're concerned about, you know, the least of which, or not the least of which, being the possibility of escape. And so, you know, I think that there's certainly a justification for the elimination of the threat that comes along with it.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess the argument is that if a prisoner is put into jail without the possibility of parole, mm-hmm. Who could have been sentenced to death but wasn't, I guess that prisoner might consider that he has nothing left to lose.
Right.
And I guess that is an argument against it. On the other hand, is it really a realistic threat that prisoners are going to escape from a modern prison? Do we have many prisoner escapes in Virginia these days?
I wouldn't call it commonplace, but it's not unheard of either. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there has been improvements in prison security with modern technology and the like. But, you know, even in the best of circumstances, You've still got inmates out numbering guards, you know, dozens to one, and it's not unheard of for, you know, prisoner-on-prisoner murders or even murders of guards in institutions. And as you said, you know, there certainly is a mentality that's present with some individuals of nothing less to lose when you've got a life sentence that you're serving, and the only punishment that would be out there would be another life sentence. Really, what is there left to punish this inmate for?
How do you feel about the possibility of making a mistake and executing an innocent man? Does that trouble you? Or
again, I think anytime you're dealing with criminal law, you're dealing with people's lives, and you always worry, I think, as a prosecutor, at least a good prosecutor should always be worried about, you know, convicting someone for that's innocent of a crime, or putting someone in jail for a crime they didn't commit, or executing someone for a crime that they didn't commit. But I firmly trust our justice system. I believe firmly that when you've got 12 men and women on a jury that's deciding a case, you've got a judge presiding over it, they're going to make the right decision. And even if in those circumstances that they don't, you've got such an appeals process involved with death penalty cases where it's being looked at by the Virginia Supreme Court and ultimately sometimes by the United States Supreme Court, that along with petitions for pardons from the governor, that you know, if there's not compelling evidence somewhere along the line, it should be caught through some of the safeguards that are present.
Okay. Well, before we leave this topic, you know that we've discussed this trial of Christ,
mm-hmm.
and we've discussed the interest of the people who put on the trial of Christ and juxtaposing the trial of Jesus on the one hand with the modern death penalty on the other. Now, you've kindly agreed to talk to me about how your religious beliefs inform your position on the death penalty. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm a Baptist faith, and you know, it's a decision I would hope that I never have to make. But if called upon to do so, I'm comfortable with my religious beliefs and my social beliefs that I would seek the death penalty if it's appropriate. I feel like, just as in a case of self-defense, for example, I would never want to be the person that had to defend myself or my family from an assailant. And while certainly, you know, my religious faith tells me that killing someone's, you know, not appropriate or not permitted, when there's justification for it, you know, I feel in my faith that it is justifiable. And I think that with someone who has committed acts against humanity that are so heinous and so vile that, you know, it's justifiable under my religious beliefs. I'm comfortable with that.
And that's our show, The Trial of Christ, The Death Penalty, Christianity, Food for Thought. I'd like to thank very much Mark Osler and Gene Bishop and Stacy Rector and all the people at Carson Newman College for allowing me to attend and participate in The Trial of Christ. I'd also like to thank Gerald Arrington, the Commonwealth's attorney for Buchanan County, Virginia. Our producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.